Welcome to the Grow Their Wealth Financial Advisor Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Ganesh.
In this episode, Jason and I talk about how he's built his practice based on client success instead of targets, what and who he learned from along the way, and how to grow without making larger clients subsidize smaller ones. He also passionately explains why he advocates for advisors to be held to a fiduciary standard, including how that would spur immense innovation in our industry and thereby improve service levels for all clients at all levels. One of my many key takeaways from the conversation was that no matter how well I think I know the answer to a planning question, the best practice is always to refer back to the source. Listen in for many more little gems.
This episode is brought to you by Valenta BPO, a provider of virtual assistants who are trained specifically in doing technical financial planning, insurance, and investment work.
Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited that you joined me, and I'm excited to get to know you a little bit better. So let's dive right
in. You might regret that. We'll see. We'll see how you feel at the end of it.
Okay, I'll let you know.
Okay, there we go. Huge mistake.
So take me back to the early days of your entry to the financial services world. What was that like?
Ooh, unconventional. So I know most people fall into this industry, but mine's a little bit different. So I was in high school. Back then we had grade 13. It was going into grade 12, and I realized that I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I was a good student, but I didn't know what. So I figured I had enough time to do a couple of work terms through a co-op program, and basically went into the office there, and they said, well, what interests you? And I had a couple of things that interested me. And of course, being a teenage boy who likes the idea of money, the financial industry and the stock market kind of tickled my fancy. So that turned into a co-op placement for 4 months at a large brokerage in Toronto. Well, one of the largest in the country, owned by one of the big banks, working for one of their largest brokers. And that 4 month placement turned into a summer job, turned into a please come back whenever you have time. So I ended up for the next couple of years, basically working through, summers, holiday week, like weeks off, March break, you name it, I would just go in and work and soak up whatever I could. And it was a great experience because I basically got to see the industry from that angle, but also got exposure to everything from, started off filing and then eventually everything from stock analysis to financial plan generation to review meeting prep to analysis. Like it was a real, I got to touch a little bit of everything. So it was great learning. And what I also learned is that I hated the bank. I hated the environment. I hated all of it. There was no metric for client success. Everything was about hitting targets and quotas and hitting and getting the brokers certain levels. And I was seeing clients oftentimes get nowhere. But at the same time, I was producing financial plans at one point when I, probably was not even qualified for it, quite honestly. It was, but nevertheless, there were at least simple cases. And looking at these things and thinking, wow, like these small changes are making there's just huge differences in clients' lives. If they just follow this plan, they're going to be significantly better off. And, the plan would get delivered. And then was there any follow-up to implementation? Who knows, right? So left there because I just basically didn't want to be there anymore.
Got an opportunity. Pause you there for a sec. So this was alongside university, or like for how long did you stay with this? Brokerage.
Finished high school, did my undergrad, graduated from my undergrad, was working there full time.
Okay, perfect. But you got a taste for it at that firm, right at high school, and through university, you kind of did placements and whatnot, and then went into full time. Okay, wow. So that's
And then the market. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. You were going to say about the market.
Yeah. Then when I left, like the market was, it was post-dot-com bubble. So the job market was also pretty terrible, but I started a independent financial plan, an independent firm with a, insurance advisor, a senior insurance advisor who was leaving his current, at the time, his current in-house, career agency to go independent. And so that basically that led to us starting that firm. And I worked there for 5 years, and I realized when I got there, I really didn't know how to run a business or run a business in that field. So that led to years of taking in a lot of best practices from around the industry and learning the ropes and doing everything that was literally everything that was involved in running a wealth management firm. And then that relationship came to an end 5 years later, and left that business and basically started Woodgate with my business partner, eventually merged it into another company. And yeah, that was, that would have been, 15 years ago now.
Right on. And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, pretty much.
What role did mentors and role models play along the way in your success?
Substantial. I won't say that I ever had a formal mentor. Looking back on it, I wish I had been more ambitious to request that. But there were many people who I would definitely pick their brains of. And I was always trying to, I was very respectful of their time, maybe a little too cautious about their time, because maybe they would have been willing to give more. But in general, there was a number of them who still to this day, you know, question my thinking on certain things and react as a reality check. But I'd say also sometimes the mentors, it's not even their direct conversations. It's the work that they've done. Right. It's the things that they've written. It's the seminars that you attend where they are. And you make a point of just anytime that person does write something or whatever it is, you make sure you're absorbing that. And so I had many informal mentors who may never realize that they actually were.
Yeah. More like role models and people who, yeah, we can learn from. Any particular ones you want to give a shout out to? And maybe it's other advisors listening to this, will benefit from following or learning from.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been privileged for a lot of people. I mean, I think the bigger influences without, they didn't realize it at the time. So John Page was an advisor who wrote a best practices manual, like, 2 decades ago, which I took a tremendous amount from. And I remember him presenting it, and we actually became friends maybe 15, 20 years later. It was actually, probably about 15 years later, we became friends. And it was like, wait a sec, did you present this? Okay, that was you. Oh my God. Like, that's the basis for so much of what I do. So his work had mentored me for years without realizing it was him. And then when that happened. And, then I would say I'm blessed and fortunate enough to have had the luck of attending class under Moshe Milevsky at York, and since then we have stayed friends and colleagues. And every now and then, he very politely checks my thinking on things, or basically advises me on how to do things different and more professionally. And everything he ever says is taken very much to heart, because when he's not one to speak up necessarily all the time, and to the point where I've told him, you need to be harder with me. but yeah, it's been, he's been a wonderful source of input. And then, I'd say frankly, in the industry today around the world, and I won't say he's a mentor of mine, but he's someone I consider a colleague and hopefully one day, a bit of a friend. But Michael Kitts is in the US. The man is prolific, and there's probably no greater role model to financial planners and advisors around the world than him at this point and what he puts out. So, and those of you who have not discovered him, please look him up, sign up for his newsletter, sign up for his podcasts, consume it all. And as I always say, if you listen to every episode of his podcast like you should, and you don't come out of it wanting to be the best version of what a financial planner can be, I don't want to know you as a human being, because something is fundamentally wrong with your moral compass.
Yeah, Kitts is incredible. The one thing I find most incredible is just the volume of content. It's like, if I want to read and listen to everything he puts out, I feel like I need to set aside a day of the week every week.
He'll be the first person saying don't do that. Just look at the things you think are relevant to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So. I don't know how he does it. Obviously, he has a team, but and it's all like super high quality stuff. Like, no matter what I look
at, nothing touches it.
I walk away saying, okay, I learned something from that. So, totally with you on that one. Well, you said you learned, you realized in the first 5 years of running the first business you were a partner of, that you didn't really know how to run a business. So what were, some of your learnings at that stage? What mistakes did you make?
Well, I think it's a simple shock of like, okay, functional aspects of the business, but you don't actually, okay, like how do you design it start to finish? Like, deer in the headlights. And that was a very almost day one realization. It's like, oh man, like I'm the guy on the factory floor that, you know, puts square peg in square hole. I'm not the guy who designs the factory line, right? So you have to do that. So, you know, what were the mistakes? You know, countless. You know, nothing so great that it stands out in my mind as, oh my God, this was a huge mistake. I think the biggest thing I learned always, and I still to this day, no matter how, you know, certain I am about something, someone comes to me about a tax question or asks me to basically, or even in public forums, it's like, okay, how does this work? Well, I know how it works, but you know what? I'm 99% certain I know how it works. What's that 1%? And I will always go back to the well of where's the resource to prove I'm right. You know, it's amazing how many of us learn things 20 years ago and repeat them over and over again and just assume they're right and never go back and double check. And the number of times I find little odd permutations or things that, oh, in that odd use case, I'm wrong, right? Like, it's never take for granted that you need to double check everything in this business, quite honestly.
Yeah, on the technical front. So what are some of the resources that you do go to check on things that you're 99% sure of?
Well, countless. So, I mean, like, first off, I'll never understand people's inability to use Google properly. It's kind of funny. Like, you know, a number of times people are like, I don't even know where to start. Have you tried Google? And just put in what you're looking for. It's astonishing because I think people just by default act helpless. But a lot of Googling.
Yeah, it's funny that incredible the sites. Google so, thing, I mean, if I can interrupt you there. My wife calls me like completely incapable of using Google. Like, she'll be like, you know, what did you search for that you didn't find the answer? So I'll put my hand up and say I'm terrible at using Google. It's something about coming up with the right keyword that seems to evade my
just
my
ask brain. The same questions, yeah. Multiple ways until you get the answer. That's it. Like that's it. It's I think, you know, it's interesting. There's an interesting point to be made there. And that is a learning skill that a lot of people lack. It's learning how to ask the right question. Right. And this is something that comes up in public forums and other things where someone asks a question or even when you're you know, even in technology sphere, where people say, I wanted to do this. Well, that's not what you really want. What is the underlying fundamental problem you're trying to solve for? Because more often than not, you have a fundamental problem that you then basically go through a mental journey and you end up with this question at the end of it. And you're like, what is this one specific thing, you know, whatever. And you don't know that the foundational question in the first place was answered correctly, right? So more often than not, you know, I always try to bring things, any kind of line of questioning back to first principles. Right? And from there, then we start with a clean slate. But as for the resources, like I said, I am just number of times people, I even on when I'm speaking at conferences, like, and people are like, what's, you know, where can I look for this? I'm like, here's the best resource in the world. Take out a pen and paper. It's a website. It's Google. And then, oh, that's, you know, I'm like, you think I'm kidding, but here's the thing. You literally ask, where do I start? Like, that should be the default answer for everything in life when you're looking for knowledge. So failing to harp on that. So, you know, Canada's blessed with a website called taxtips.ca, which is a utterly fantastic, you know, my buddies refer to it as literally the Bible of tax in Canada. Then, you know, basically a lot of the more, you know, the questions about how should I do something or where should I do or how should I handle something in investments? You know, the reality, if it's not tax-based, if it's investment-based, academia has solved this a million times over. Like, that's the reality of it. So, you know, searching academic journals for topics, searching, you know, I'll give a shout out to Ben Felix's work on Common Sense Investing and Rational Reminder. You know, they've done a great job of bringing academic research to the forefront, and, you know, searching his YouTube videos is a great shortcut for where do you look next. Countless resources. I've built up a massive Evernote library of all these conference materials that I've collected over the years, right? So it's like, oh, what was that tax change 6 years ago that I learned about at the STEP conference? Well, what happened, you know, what year did it happen? There's the actual deck and go through it, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to be your own. Yeah, be your own curator. But honestly, you'd be amazed. Like, even the most abstract tax issues, you'd be amazed at what you can find that are posted by good authorities out there. By, you know, a buddy of mine basically said the other day, all I do when I get asked a tax question by another financial advisor is I type in the question and then Jamie Gollenbeck at the end, right? And, you know, sure enough, Jamie's literally written about everything in this country, right? And, like, and, you know, when I get stumped to the point of like, okay, this is, I've never seen anyone write about this. It's just like, so I have this problem, Jamie, and I get an answer. So whenever possible, and doesn't matter who's giving the answer, get the source material. Always request the source, because you know it's just too easy to take for granted that we're wrong a lot more than we're right.
Yeah, right on. And what about insurance and estate related questions? I find that one's the hardest to find answers to.
I don't know. I think that there's a lot of good law firms that put out a lot of good material out there. The insurance world, here's the thing with the insurance world. The insurance world is rife with quote unquote education that has nothing more than sales tactics, right? This came up on LinkedIn the other day where I took a shot at the infinite banking concept is nothing but absolute lies, and just a pure sales tactic. And the reality, you know, most people were absolutely supportive of the fact that I said that, but it's one of these things where people get converted to the belief that that is the ultimate solution, right? And you know, here's the problem with this industry in Canada on the whole. Okay, the vast majority of education in this industry in Canada comes from who?
The product suppliers. Yeah, the suppliers. Yeah.
Do you think they have an agenda?
Sure.
Yeah, they have an agenda. Is that agenda rooted in evidence and actually what's best interest from the client? Maybe, but not necessarily. Right. So this is the problem: is that we literally are letting pour Kool-Aid down our throats. So when it comes to it on the insurance world, I'd say there's a handful of organizations where you can learn the actual like really complex tax stuff related to that. And frankly, like, you know, STEP is probably the best one for that. Covers tax and estate and insurance quite well. I will warn people, that is the conference I go to every year that my brain hurts at the end of it. It is a lot to take in. CTF, Canadian Tax Federation, also covers a lot of that. And frankly, the reality is, you know, most of the best insurance, there's a lot of good materials from MGAs and insurance companies. You got to filter through they just want me to sell this. But where is the actual valid use case where this applies versus something else, right? And realize that, you know, hey, that concept is great. And yeah, it's going to pay a huge commission, which is always the wrong reason to do things. But it comes down to, okay, when does this actual use case work? And what is the checklist for when I would even contemplate it, right? So unfortunately, we're left to our own devices to figure a lot of that out. And that's why so many people are led astray by the marketing that exists.
So the world of planning, obviously, it's very, very complex. If you want, you can spend endless, countless hours on a particular client file. So how have you set up your business so that you can take the time that a file requires?
Well, it's by design. So the first thing, and I'm going to actually go back and say the comment I made earlier was wrong. We're wrong more than we're right. No, we think we're right more often than we are, is what it comes down to. So going back to this question. So it's by design, first off. End of the day, if you look at the surveys on how many clients advisors have well, service in this country, it's something in the neighborhood of 300 households. Now, just do the basic math. How many people can you legitimately meet with over the course of a year? And given that the benchmark number for financial planning, for the amount of time it takes to produce a financial plan is around 10 hours per engagement, how many financial plans can you legitimately do? And this is one of the major reasons why planning doesn't get done. A, it's a lot of work, and B, it takes a lot of time. So how do you deliver? How do you make sure you have that time? It is by design of your service offering. Look, the broader the service offering, the more you want to do for people, the more you want to offer them, the fewer people you can actually serve. You are the bottleneck. You are the bottleneck because of two things. One, time. And two, there's a concept out there called the Dunbar number. Okay. It is a threshold for human capacity for keeping relationships straight in one's mind. That number arguably exists between 100 to 200 and averaging 150. So what does that mean? That's a number of relationships that I can keep straight without ever having to reference anything else. So, you know, you see your mother, you know who your mother is. There's no question, right? You see someone you did business with 3 years ago, you maybe remember them, but you don't remember the context.
And this is
right?
for both so personal and professional, right? This is just the number of relationships a person can handle and really remember. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So let's just say you subtract parents and family, and I got a big family, so I get, you know, subtract out of that. So let's just say that, you know, you're down to probably at most 100 households, probably less, that you can literally have a relationship where if they called you, you could pick up the phone and without checking a CRM or any notes, you would know where you left off last time. at most. Okay. So that's the first thing. Now, why is that important? Because who the heck wants to pay an advisor to have a relationship like a call center? Oh, hello, John. Yeah, thanks for calling. Let me put you on hold a minute while I look up your note, the notes from our last meeting to see who it is you are, right? Like that is a terrible experience, right? And that's also not an effective one in financial planning, because in order to be effective as a financial planner, you need to have an understanding of that person's life before you give advice.
The full right? context so you have to understand of it, that. So yeah.
Exactly, right? So you have to have an understanding of your head around the entirety of their existence, right? And then when they come to you and ask, what about this thing that just happened to me? Be able to reference the entirety of that existence without saying, okay, hold on. I appreciate that, John, but give me, you know, a day, because I have to go over your entire history now because I can't remember because I service 300 households. So the first thing is by design. So you look at it, and this is a trend that the RIA market in the US has discovered a long time ago. It's that you keep on upping your service and you keep on reducing your headcount in terms of households. That does mean you correspondingly have to run an efficient business and one where people are paying you the corresponding clearing price, which makes it, you know, which means you're typically servicing larger high net worth people. But anyway, so the point is that we try to keep our household count in the 80s or lower. So right now we're a little bit over that as a firm. We're expanding, we're hiring someone, but that, you know, ideally my ideal future is 60 relationships at most, right? That's how you do it. That's how you ensure that there's enough time to do the planning work. That said, you can absolutely, and we do ourselves too. We utilize a specialized planner who does nothing but produce financial plans. I get involved in the more complex cases to deal with that, because that's really my expertise. But you know, that plan is generated by that person. But at the same time, the information that goes into it and information that comes out of it is the knowledge or the purview of the person who manages that relationship. So we may not be doing the heavy lifting on every case, but we are basically still aware of all the content.
You still have to know it. You still have to have the context. It's just you've saved some time inputting data and running scenarios and doing some of the simpler planning tasks as far as goes. But how do you, I mean, like you've been in the business for 20 years. Has it always been that you've been able to maintain a 60, 80, 100 client count? How have you, I suppose, passed off some of the smaller clients to other advisors? How do you do that well?
Yeah, so a couple of things, you know, and I absolutely did not maintain that. When we took over another practice and merged in, it was 1,100 households amongst three advisors. Now, that was a lot of group RSP business in there as well. So there was a lot of very low touch transactional business there, which wasn't really something we wanted to be involved in. We still support group RSPs, but solely for the business owners we deal with. So when we look at so how do we solve this problem? So first off, you know, you're not doing anyone favors by keeping them on when you're beyond capacity. Let's just face it. You're not, right? You're not going to service them to the same standard, and you're just not going to be effective. You're literally taking away from the clients who are actually paying you, right? The small ones are quite honestly, in most, depending on how you run your business, probably not profitable or maybe not as profitable as the other ones. So let me give you a quick scenario. Imagine you basically said to your largest client, thank you. Thank you so much for paying me this much money per year, because that's enabled me to service 100 other tiny clients who are nowhere near.
You're basically subsidizing everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Now, there's always some of that. There's always some of that, but it's the degree to which it happens is the issue, right? So, you know, I should not be maintaining barely profitable clients based on the back of a very highly profitable client. That doesn't make any sense. So, and the other piece is never forget that your C&D clients are someone else's A and B clients. Like, that's the reality of it. There's always someone else out there who's at a different stage of their career who those clients are valuable to. And frankly, this is a seller's market in this industry. There are not enough books up for sale. There are not enough, you know, advisors do not retire fast enough. A lot of them end up dying on the job, unfortunately. But the reality is that the multiples in this business are extremely high. So what do we do? You know, the first and obvious one was we packaged up the groups and we sold off the groups, right? That eliminated, I kid you not, that eliminates 700 households out of 1,100. Okay. So that was the first tranche. Then the second tranche was to another advisor who basically, you know, actually someone I knew in the industry for a long time, who was basically looking to become an advisor, and we trained him up and gave him a start, right? So we basically eventually got the firm down to a little over 200 households. And that was over the course of three sales. Now, the other question comes up is like, geez, like that's giving up a lot of revenue. As a business owner, you have to be concerned with that, right? Well, here's the thing. I will tell you right now, I have not had a single liquidation event where we didn't get back to the same level of assets inside of 12 months. Why? because you free up so much time and resources that your business development initiatives start getting better. The service offering that you have gets better and therefore drives in more referrals. So kid you not, every time it was like dip and then boom, like dip, boom. And we, you know, we did, like I said, three sales and you can see our entire, like you can see our revenue and asset pattern, dip back to normal, dip back to normal, dip back to normal. And it took three of them, but we got there.
Yeah. Back to normal or back to normal and then some.
Well, back to, well, I would say it's a far better, superior experience, right? Because it is, you know, don't get me wrong, we've gone well beyond that now. We've gone well beyond where we were before. But for a while there, we were stagnating for a number of years. We were around the same AUM threshold, but the underlying fundamental numbers of the business kept on improving substantially.
You were becoming more and more profitable because you were spending less time, less resources dealing with all the smaller clients.
And then, of course, what's in it for the clients? What's in it for the clients is the time and attention and care increased concurrently with that, because we were not distracted by all these small needs. Like most of it was just like, especially the group business, it was all transactional. It was all like, I need to set up an account or I need to take money out. It was, you know, that is a business that frankly is better these days handled by the robo advisors than anyone else at this point. They didn't exist back in the day, but yeah, that's, you know, you think about that. If you could free up, ask yourself today, if you could free up 30% of your time, how much better could you service everybody else? How much faster could you grow?
Yeah, and what and was what when you sold those books? Like, what was the dip in revenue? Like, you sold 700 households, but was it a 10%? It was a 10% of the revenue. Was it 20%? It must have been a relatively
well. It's a dip in revenue, but in exchange for a purchase price. Right. So we've done deals as a combination of upfront and then, you know, periodic lump sums. We've done deals as recurring revenue. Right. So we'll split the recurring revenue for a period of time. So, you know, the group one was interesting because we had a hard time valuing it because it was so many people. That one we just did as a split for several years. Right. So the dip was, you know, frankly, half the revenue from that amount. Plus we received a small sum upfront. So it wasn't like, again, it's not that you're trading off, right? And if anything, I say, look, if you want to be really specific about this, right, end of the day, you're going to sell part of a business for between 2 to 4 times whatever the revenue is, right? Okay, fine. Whatever the multiple is, that's how many years you have to get back to break even,
yeah,
so that you're not behind. I mean, like, those are mental mental constructs that I don't really buy into, but they really do help other people kind of wrap their head around, okay, I can pull that off. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any resources or tips for someone who is, you know, has built up this broad, multifaceted, multi-headed business, and they realize, okay, we need to pare down, I need to package up, you know, certain areas and sell them. Like, where do they start?
I think first and foremost, and I've seen a lot of really bad attempted transactions here. People just think, yeah, I'm going to sell it and I'm going to start a conversation and it'll somehow miraculously happen. No, first and foremost, package, if you want the top multiple for this, A, you have to package up the offering like you're a professional. So, I mean, literally, I mean, by the time I did the second time, I basically said, okay, here's the deal. And I gave the guy a 6-page document. And that document was, you know, here's the number of households, here's the assets, here's the breakdown of assets based on age, here's the breakdown of households with the names redacted and how much they had in assets in each of them. Here's the breakdown based on vendor. Here's the revenue. Here's the overhead that comes with it. Like, literally gave him a breakdown of exactly what he was buying, and it was just like, took one look at it. He's like, okay.
Yeah, make it easy for them to buy. Don't make them chase you down for all of those numbers that a prudent buyer would be asking.
The number of times I've heard of people saying, like, yeah, I'm thinking about buying a book, but the guy's been able to give me numbers in 3 months. It's like, well, walk away. Like, how organized is this person?
Sure. Right?
Even the client files, like, we have everything digitized. We were able to basically, you know, once he agreed to the deal and it was like, we had a month before it happened, we were, you know, my assistant was dragging and dropping, you know, copies of those files onto a USB card stick to hand over, right, as part of that entire transition. So, like, literally, you know, the thing got done and it was like, okay, here's your first day, here's your USB stick, this is what, you know, you've got everything you need, right? So the more you package it up and the more organized your business is, the more easy it is to package up and organize, you know, the sale, right? And then, you know, that's really the first piece. Negotiating these things, I'll tell you, there's not a lot of good resources out there for this. But here's a couple of good tips. Like I said, it depends on, you know, if you're independent, odds are you're going to be able to sell. You know, I've seen the most terrible books with no organization, no nothing, sell for at least almost 2x revenue. Fine. But realistically, every deal I see is between 3 and 4x revenue. And here's what I'll tell you. That is not cheap. That is really not cheap. Because essentially, especially if you're, you know, it's your first time out and you're buying that, like if you don't already have the apparatus and the scale, you can just add that on top. It's just, oh, I can already handle this without any new resources. And therefore it's all profit to the bottom line. If you're buying a job, that is not cheap. But frankly, you don't really have a choice in this business. That's the problem, right? And frankly, you know, even crappy advisors have retention rates that are 95 to 97%. So the reality is that even though the numbers are big, the churn is incredibly low, right? So that's what makes the math work. So, and then there are other organizations, the ICPMs I see out there, that will offer more than that, usually on the condition that you convert over their product, right? So there's a loss of independence. The only way it makes sense is if they basically monetize as a manufacturer. So you have to wrestle with the morality of if that's what you want or not. But in general, like if you're gonna sell something, there's a couple levers you pull. Like there's, you know, basically the price is a factor of how much is gonna be paid up front versus how much is being paid out slowly over time. Basically, what is the escrow amount? How much money, you know, there's gonna be some sort of, hey, I have to receive X percentage of the total assets in the transition on a warm handoff. And if I lose below this, you know, more than this amount goes, then the price adjusts. And then what's the floor, right? What's the bare minimum you're guaranteeing the seller that is, right? So every decision that favors the buyer increases the price. Every decision that favors the seller decreases the price, right? So I will say, I wish there was a book I could point you to say, this is exactly how you do it. Not quite.
Isn't one yet.
It's a bit of an art you have to live through.
Right on. And what if you're, you know, buying in order to set up a business or grow a practice? Is that a good idea in your opinion?
It comes, so I've seen people get themselves into a lot of trouble with that model, right? Because they just buy, looking to just, they're trying to acquire revenue. But the problem is that you can't scale a financial planning business that fast, right? So these people grow to the point where they're breaking, everything's breaking. Right. So if you're going to buy a business, if you're starting from zero, right, like you got all the time in the world. So it's not that hard. If you already have an existing practice, you have to be very cognizant of about what are the number of relationships you're bringing on? What is the service offering they're used to? Right. Like if you cannot swallow that capacity, all you're going to do, it's a simple math equation, right? Number of hours per client goes down. Right. Especially, and it's worse for the existing clients you have, because guess what? Disproportionate amount of times you go to the new ones because you're trying to secure them. So if anything, you're alienating and poorly servicing the existing clients in order to favor the new clients. Not exactly what clients are signed up for, right? So, you know, really, if you're going to do something like that, you better do it with consideration for capacity. Otherwise, you're going to make your life miserable.
Absolutely. How else do you manage your time? Like you did talk about having a team, getting a financial planner, handing off, some of the planning work. Like what else do you do to manage your time?
Automate little things, delegate and say no wherever possible. That's not to say it's not a struggle. I mean, I'm at a period in my life right now where I am overworked. Part of that's because, you know, we've grown to the point where we need to expand capacity, right? That person comes in, gets fully trained up. I'm in a better place, right? I mean, I would at one point, a couple of years back, I was at the stage where Woodgate was taking maybe 3.5 days a week, right? Assuming nothing was wrong and there was no ongoing projects, 3.5 days a week. The other day and a half was left to all the other side stuff I would do. And a lot of successful advisors at a certain age get to that, and you know they start taking 3 days and 4 days off a week. That's not me. I would rather work on the widget and work on other stuff and basically enjoy enjoy that stuff as opposed to just sit around doing nothing. No judgment to others who do that. But point is that, you know, that was a stage I was at, and that was great because if something, you know, if a client had an urgent matter, I had the capacity to expand the amount of time spent on Woodgate to deal with their issue, right? Now I'm at a bit of a stage where a lot of my side hustle stuff has to be pushed to the wayside because I don't have as much latitude. But part of it, like I said, this is math. This is in a lot of ways, simple math. Average engagement takes X amount of time. Number of engagements, the threshold is the limit is how many hours are there in a year that you can legitimately work plus a buffer. That is it. that is it. Plus, I mean, subtract out the time just for running your practice and the basic stuff, right? The reality is this is just a math equation. And if the sooner you wrap your head around that, that you have to engineer your business to operate off a basic equation, the better off you're going to be.
What's your ideal time spent in the business? Is it 3.5 days? Is it less? Like, and how much time would you like to have for all the side projects that you are involved in?
Yeah, I think 3.5 is a great one because I can commit a full day to all the side stuff that I'm working on, and the extra half day is usually more than enough to catch up on other stuff that comes up in the business. So that was pretty much the ideal framework I was working with. I hope to get back to that shortly.
Do you do any time blocking? Like, how do you organize your week?
So to a degree, I do some time blocking, right? So unfortunately, not to the same degree I should. So absolutely, I every Sunday, I basically organize my week for the coming week. And in advance, everything's blocked off. So there's the same routine stuff in the morning. There is a time at which nothing is allowed to be booked. Other than that, my schedule is kept pretty wide open. And I have my Calendly set up so that different types of meetings, I have different types of meetings, different types of calls, so that when someone wants to meet on something, I can send them that. And whatever limitations there are around that are basically automatically baked into the booking, right? So, for example, if I only want to do like full financial plan meetings 2 days a week in order to make sure that I have other staff or I can just focus, or better example, if I want to make sure I do no more than 2 to 3 of those per day, right, I can limit that within Calendly to do that. So other than that, I let people self-select in. Fridays are largely blocked off for other things like our conversation today. And yeah, that's basically it. I've seen some people, and then whenever I have a bigger project, I try to block off specifically, not in the morning, specifically later in the day, because morning I'm putting out fires, later in the day to basically just work on nothing but that.
Right on. And when did you start delegating? Like, what was the threshold in terms of either revenue or just pure, like, I'm frustrated, I can't handle everything, I need to start delegating? Like, what's the point at which?
Yeah, my experience is very different because when I took over that other practice, it was much larger and had already had staff in place. And I still remember the first weekend, just handing work off for the first time. I'm like, this is awesome. This is fantastic. Just the ability to just delegate is just superb, right? So to me, it was, I didn't hit that threshold. But what I'll tell people when it comes to delegation, right? Like, end of the day, a lot of times people have the mental barrier, the mental threshold that, oh, they have to pay for an entire human body. No, you don't. There's this thing called virtual assistant work out there. And you can hire blocks of hours per week for virtual assistants to handle the heavy lifting repetitive tasks that you want to do. Now, you can also find, there's also all kinds of heavy lifting repetitive tasks that are better handled through technology that you can find a very simple off-the-shelf technology to do. Calendly, perfect example, right? I don't book my own meetings. My staff, we used to have a simple story. Our receptionist used to spend 60% of her time 60-70% of her time booking, rebooking, and confirming meetings. That was it. I heard that number. When I heard that number got to that point, I'm like, okay, that's the last straw. What are my options? So did a survey of calendar tools out there, found the one that worked for us, implemented it. Within 2 months, she was down to less than 20% of her time involving that. And that was solely because of, certain senior clients or still people, we still haven't converted over fully. But you think about the productivity savings. Like, think about this. Like, I was paying for almost, like, let's call it close to 50% of a full-time employee in Toronto, what that value was worth. And I replaced that with software that starts at $60 a month.
Yeah.
Right. So, but, and of course, I still kept the person and think about the productivity. Now that productivity is more focused on higher value stuff. Right. So there are lots of very simple self-service like tools out there that will give you actually better experience than what you currently have now that solve heavy lifting problems. Second piece is, if you don't wait to get a full body, get a virtual assistant. And then once the virtual assistant gets to a point where like you need a full body, then you hire a full body. And actually it's cheaper to hire a full person than it is to hire a virtual assistant full time because, hey, there's a revenue premium for the business there. Right. So that's the advice that I usually give on that.
Yeah. Right on. How did you start getting involved in, marketing your business? Obviously you write articles, you do, you're part of some media interviews, you're out there, but how did that journey start?
It's another funny story. So in my final class at Schulich, I wrote a term paper that Molesky liked so much that he basically emailed me personally and said, "That was a great job. Here's an A+, like fantastic work." And, you know, I looked at the screen and took a deep breath and said, I often say to myself, fortune favors the bold. And I said, if you liked it that much, help me get it published. To which he basically kind of, I'm sure I can picture him now with a smug look on his face being like, okay, kid. But he basically said, look, this isn't ready for academia, but here is the editor of advisor.ca at the time. Right. So he introduced me. I sent the paper over. The guy's like, oh yeah, we want you writing stuff for us. Right. So that started that journey, which then got me a little bit more. Once you get into the media, you get a little bit more exposed to the media, so they start to find you. I'll be honest, I took a bit of a hiatus. Business got to be pretty busy for a while. I was still having people in the media find me on occasion, so that was fine. Still kept going. But then Globe Advisor offered me a column, and I finally said, okay, I've had this like multi-year writer's block I need to get over, and that's the end of it. So I still find writing painful. You know, it's like giving birth with your brain. It on some level it hurts, and you're always, especially when you're a perfectionist around this stuff like I am, you're never really happy with the product. And so that was a big part of it.
Do you enjoy marketing? Like, is there anything else you do for marketing?
Yes. I mean, like, I don't even look at it as marketing, right? Like, I'm out there either having fun or answering questions people pose to me, or, you know, basically pointing out things need to change in this industry. You know, that's it. Like, that's the reality of it. I am advocating for true professional financial planning is what I'm doing. You know, on Twitter half the time I'm just making jokes and bad emojis. But nevertheless, the point is, you know, those opportunities to, you know, when something comes up about the industry, you know, boom, I hit people like a hammer, right? Like it just comes, you know, it just flows. And a lot of it's based on frustration. So do I enjoy it? I still think it's still painful for me to write anything long form. You know, I think it through way too much. I sit down and I have to force myself to do it. But once it starts going, I actually enjoy it, right? When I'm actually in the middle of it, I enjoy it, but it's that starting point. Like I get behind this mental eight ball of wanting perfection and not being, and never being ready to start. But I do. Once I start, it's great. As for all the stuff I do on social media or anything, or on television on occasion or my podcast, those are just enjoyable. Like, to me, they're just enjoyable conversations. And I really don't kind of look at it as a real marketing concern, but it's out there and it gets me out there.
How do most clients find you?
Every which way imaginable. Honestly, I the one thing, all my problems right now are problems of abundance. So I count myself lucky. But literally, it's, yes, online, through media, advisor directories, articles that I publish, social media, professional referrals, other advisors referring cases that they feel are too complex for them. I won't say that there's any one thing we focus in on. We focus in on simply like delivering a very high value service, letting it be known that we are providing this for a high level of complexity, and basically advocating. And we do that and we get recognition for it. And that recognition leads to generation. So, I have no time or place for conventional marketing. It's just being out there has basically brought it all in.
How do you charge for your services?
So, here's the interesting thing. It's an interesting question, because it's all based around design. So let me ask you a question. What do you call a doc? What is a doctor done when they perform surgery before they diagnose someone? What's that act called?
The act of performing before diagnosis?
Surgery before diagnosis. If a doctor actually did that, what's the legal term for that?
Oh, surgery before diagnosis. Gosh. I don't know what the legal term is, but it's
that would be malpractice, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's bad. Yeah.
Malpractice. Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you something. Why is it that the industry by default tells clients how they should invest their money before they do financial plans for them?
Yeah, it's always something that's, beats me.
Completely backwards. You know why? Because at the end of the day, they're really after the assets, which, fair, we can admit that. And unfortunately, these people are putting financial planning secondary. And also, they're afraid to charge for it. But so let me go back to how I get compensated. we charge $7,500 to onboard a client in the first year upfront. That $7,500 allows us to put in place a comprehensive financial plan and an IPS with full disclosure of all fees going forward. Okay. That allows us to put the horse before the cart. And from there, we continue on through our process of the risk management review, tax planning reviews, estate planning reviews, and then a bunch of ancillary services for business owners and others. But by charging a first-year onboarding fee, we're able to actually diagnose the patient properly and then make recommendations on investment. Because frankly, here's the thing. Okay, I do a cursory review and put them in a portfolio. Fine. You go back and do the financial plan and you find fundamental information that basically results in you having made the wrong decision in the first place. It makes no sense. And, you know, when we meet with prospects about this, this often comes up. It's, well, why is it you're charging when no one else is upfront? And we say, look, we're doing it because we want to put the financial plan first, and here's why. And when we say to people, like, essentially, when we say to people, we make sure we understand who you are, what it is you want out of life, what you own, what you owe, what's coming to you, where it's going, all of that. And we map out your entire life before we tell you how to invest your money. Because we need that information, plus your risk tolerance, risk capacity, which we calculate through the financial plan anyway, before we can even tell you what allocation you should be going into. That's why we charge. The better question is why everybody else is doing it backwards. Right? So that's the first part of the conversation. Well, actually, usually the first part of the first response is typically, you know, they'll simply say, well, these other people are offering the financial plan for quote unquote free. My response is, when's the last time you got something for free that was worth a damn? And you know what the reaction is? They always almost universally laugh and it hits them. It's true. Because here's the thing. As a financial planner, you literally just put a price of zero on something. What do you think that did to the perception of worth of that? Right. So the reality is, and I, you know, when I started doing this, we started doing this probably 10 years ago plus. It was more or less unheard of, right? We were charging less at the time, but it was more or less unheard of. And we basically have always advocated for this. And since then, I'll tell you, like, I saw some people in the US doing it before. Now it's very common in the US for a financial planning fee to be done before you get to the asset management. Very common in the RIA space. In Canada, a handful. I start to see more and more people doing it slowly, but there's also a lot of firms who won't let you do it, which I find astonishing.
Yeah, that one's tough to swallow. And you've chosen not to charge an ongoing fee for planning.
No, we do charge. So hold on. So let's be clear. What is the ongoing asset management fee for? The ongoing asset management fee is for all of our services combined going forward.
Including the financial planning.
So the financial planning, exactly, right? Which everybody else is telling them that's what's paying for the financial plan initially. But again, the financial plan is not being done initially, or is it even being done at all? Let's be honest, right? You know, like you know,
that's what I see. I think there's an opportunity to charge. I mean, it's almost better to continue to charge because then the client knows that you know, they're paying for something, they should be getting it. And so there's no ambiguity on whether that's included or not. But well, I guess,
But let's be honest. Okay. So let's sum this up. Okay. So what is your value proposition as an advisor? If it is access to markets, guess what? You've lost, right? That is a commodity, right? That is a commodity with a clearing price of between 25 to 50 basis points that the robo advisors have done. Now, I don't care if you can argue that you do a better job because you can't predict the future. Okay. You cannot predict the future. None of us can guarantee better returns, full stop. Right. And I'm not even going to get into the active versus passive debate because frankly, active loses outright. But the point here is that if you're an advisor whose sole value proposition is access to markets and market return, you are already behind the eight ball because you are now competing with something 50 to 75 basis points cheaper than you on average, because the average advisor charges at least 1%, if not more, right? So let's just call it between 50 to 1% more. So why would someone pay three times more, at least, for your services? Well, it better not just be access to markets, right? If the financial plan is not the core of your relationship and the implementation of the financial plan and the update and the stewardship that comes with that, that is something that cannot be replaced. Right. Now, that being said, you know, people said, well, you know, we'll replace financial planners and advisors with like with software and technology. Okay, great. The number of failed direct to consumer financial planning softwares that exist out there, I've lost count. That is, you know, I get that idea pitched to me at least twice a year. Every time I tell people to do something different, and thus far, every last one of them has failed. Right. And the ones who haven't failed, they continue to be out there, but they're cottage businesses. They're not major. The reality is a lot of people say they would like to do that, but the complexity of the financial world is not such that they're going to be able to understand everything that goes in there without the proper education and training. Right. So that's the first piece. The second piece is basically like the plan is worthless without implementation. A financial planner's true real value is in the implementation of that over time and the adjustment as the client's life evolves. Right. So the reality is that, yeah. Do I feel comfortable charging a normal conventional market rate compared to a robo-advisor? Absolutely. The value I provide is orders of magnitude beyond that. Should anyone who's basically just saying, well, all I do is the investment side, good luck to you. Good luck.
Yeah, well,
to
I mean,
you.
And because, then the Questrade ads frankly, actually, you know, resonate for, you know, an advisor who's just doing that.
So this is an, I have written two articles criticizing Questrade's position on a number of things. Like here's where I absolutely agree with them. When they basically target the quote unquote, what I call do nothing advisors, the advisors who just put you in a fund and leave you alone forever, like fair play. In fact, you know what? Go after them 100 times over.
100%.
When you fail to, exactly. When you paint the entire industry with the same brush and you fail to even acknowledge any possible value of value delivery by a financial planner or advisor at all, you're just lying now. You're just absolutely lying. And there's actual studies that show that you're lying.
I like it. Great perspective for advisors. Totally agree. What's one thing you wish would change in our industry? Is that it? Or can you think of anything else?
Oh God, so much. so much. Where to start? I mean, first and foremost, a universal fiduciary rule. We think about this. If you pulled the average Canadian aside and said, "Do you think your financial advisor has a legal responsibility to act in your best interest at all times?" The answer would probably be yes, or holy crap, I sure as hell hope so. And the answer is no. Like, you know, even under CFR, the closest we've gotten now is suitability, right? Suitability, but not fiduciary. Right? We're just mincing words. At the end of the day, you know, frankly, the banks don't want it, but nevertheless, that's a separate point. The end of the day, like this is about principle at the end of the day, like when it comes down to it. We are being entrusted with people's entire financial futures. That is something that should come with the highest standard of care imaginable. So that's standard one. The second piece, and this is the thing that will transform this country forever, this industry in this country forever, is the abolition of all forms of embedded compensation in all financial products, period. Because at that point, then there's no more line. It's in black and white everywhere. And the reality is, it's too easy to sell people. And when I say that, also let me also clarify, and the full disclosure of embedded costs within these funds, all in the same statement. Because we do have statements that show what the advisor was paid, but we don't have statements showing what the underlying cost was, right? And that's a problem. So full and complete total disclosure of costs and the elimination of any embedded compensation in all products, period. Because I'll tell you what's happened. That has happened elsewhere in the world, yeah, UK being the
UK,
prime example.
Australia have done that. And arguably, they have seen a lot of advisors quit, which has done a disservice to a lot of consumers, that especially the lower end or the less wealthy.
So that's what
ones.
You're told, is it? That's
yeah,
what
so tell me what's right.
There are certain organizations that have been out there preaching that story for a long time as a means of trying to prevent from happening in Canada. Here's what's actually happened. Okay, so did that happen in the UK? Absolutely. 30% of advisors basically disappeared within a short period of time. Now, let's be fair. There's a certain cohort of advisors who are too old to ever bother doing anything, right? Oh, you made it too difficult to me. I'm just going to retire. Something like, what is it? The average age of financial advisors is over 55, right? So there's an entire cohort in their late 60s that were just never going to do it, right? Fine. You know what happened since in the UK? That 30% dip was more than replaced inside of 3 years. And guess what happened? The consumer satisfaction rates were through the roof in comparison. There's greater degrees of trust. There's greater professionalism. There's more people who basically actually conduct themselves in a professional manner. Outcome has increased dramatically. So the line about this being a jobs issue is BS. Okay, it is a narrative that's been pushed by certain organizations that I will not name here who have fought embedded compensation being banned for a long time. The Australian model is still in the works. they recently, more recently, a couple of years ago, passed a regulation that basically said that, hey guys, you're professionals. Great. You should be educated like professionals, shouldn't you? So here's what we require. We require that you have a post-secondary, degree or certificate in the field of study, a certification, like a CFP or whatever it is, I'm pretty sure it's whatever it is down there, a minimum of a year's worth of experience, and you have to do valid continue education on a regular basis. Oh, and guess what? We're not grandfathering you. We're not grandfathering you at all, because guess what? If you're a professional, you should at least have this. And if you don't have this, too bad, because it's about the consumer. It's not about you, right? So that means, guess what? If you don't have the CFP or equivalent, you got three years they gave them. If you don't have a post-secondary degree, you have fine. Otherwise, get out. 25% of the Australian advisor force met the criteria to start. 25. Okay. Should we have a advisory force? Should we have should we have lawyers who've never been to law school? Can you imagine if only 25% of lawyers went to law school?
Yeah,
25% of doctors went to med school? Like, can you imagine? Who can possibly call that a profession, right? So you know what? Yes, there's going to be a little bit of blood in the streets when this happens. And yes, here's the thing. To argue that small clients suffer, you know what you're missing here? That is an argument against capitalism, which I find astonishing for these guys who consider themselves capitalists to make. If there is a market willing to pay for a service, there are capitalists who will find ways of creating distribution models and companies that are profitable at that level. That's the truth. Okay. And that is what we're seeing elsewhere in the world where transitions like this have happened. All of this nonsense, I am utterly astonished constantly by the narratives that are passed off in this country. And no one actually ever goes and looks at the research or speaks to the people from those countries, Canada, the US, internationally, who look at us, who look at Canada like a regulatory backwater and honestly wonder how it's possible we are this messed up. India banned deferred sales charge like 12 years ago. South Africa banned it probably over 15 years ago. And we were still having the argument. It took a massive fight up until 2021 to get it finally last nail put in the grave.
Yeah, and it's funny for
this is what we put up
all
with.
The people who say and think that consumers aren't willing to pay up front. Consumers are willing to pay up front. They will pay more when they know what they're getting, and they want it. There's huge demand in the Canadian marketplace. I know
but
that
think
from
about
experience.
The sad indictment. Yeah. But think about the sad indictment of their belief in their own skill set. They are literally saying, "I am not. If I had to put my price tag up on a piece of paper, no one would pay it." Right. That is a confession that you are not worth it, or you see yourself as not worth it. So maybe that's true. Maybe it's true. Maybe you do provide it. Maybe you're admitting to the fact that you're providing a service not worth paying for. Well, then you got a bigger problem, because you shouldn't exist as a business if that's the case. Right. But if you literally believe you provide value, yet you believe people won't pay for it, how do you reconcile that in your mind? How does that make any sense?
Love it. Well, I think we're up to the end of our time for today. Thank you so much, Jason. That's been a really fun conversation. We should do this again sometime.
You should hit me with the stuff at the end, the beginning. We got a lot more animated throughout.
Awesome.
All right. Take care of yourself.
Thanks for joining us on yet another episode of the Grow Their Wealth Financial Advisor Podcast. Stay tuned for our next episode and write me at sham@growyourwealth.ca. That's SHYAM at growyourwealth.ca with feedback, questions, and even suggestions of guests I should invite to the show. See you next time.